So I like to begin with a quote. We haven't done that yet, but I kind of like this. So this is by my favorite Christian thinker. And this reads, paradoxically then, even though the problem of suffering is the greatest objection to the existence of God, at the end of the day, God is the only solution to the problem of suffering. If God does not exist, then we are locked without hope in a world filled with pointless and unredeemed suffering. So if you didn't get the hint, today we're going to be talking about the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. However, we're going to recap our last week beforehand. If you remember, we wrapped up our theistic arguments for the existence of God. We covered four: the argument from the beginning of the universe, known as the Kalam cosmological; the argument from the fine tuning of the universe, known as the teleological; the moral argument; and an argument from information. We then turned to our arguments against God's existence, beginning with, if God exists, why doesn't he make it more clear? And if God created everything, who created God? So that was last week. This week, we are going to be talking about the most common objection to God and Christianity at large, and that is the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. And this is kind of split into two different sections. You have the intellectual problem of evil, pain, and suffering, and the emotional. We're going to begin by starting with the intellectual and probably get to the emotional next week, because this is a long topic. And I love talking about this. This is my favorite thing to talk about outside of the resurrection. So this is my favorite thing to cover. And I want to take our time with it because it is the biggest objection. It's the reason some people leave the church. A lot of people leave the church. And it's something we all struggle with at times. So I want to give this the attention it deserves and really cover it and make sure we get it. I'd also like to remind you of our three goals for this class: to learn to love the Lord our God with all of our mind, to fulfill the command and example of apologetics in Scripture that we talked about our first week, and to better prepare ourselves when we go through trials. And that last goal is extremely relevant today. If you know the good reasons God has for permitting evil, pain, and suffering, when you fall into pain and suffering, it will be easier for you. So we're going to begin then with the logical problem of evil, which goes something like this: an all-loving God has the desire to stop evil. An all-powerful God has the ability to stop evil. Evil exists, therefore an all-powerful and all-loving God does not exist. It's either he's not all-powerful, he's not all-loving, or he doesn't exist at all. As I told Krista, I think last week, the moral argument is better understood when you see it in practice. And here's an example of this. Because evil wouldn't be evil if God doesn't exist. And that's because you can't call something objectively wrong if there's no objective standard of morality to judge it by. And if you need God to have an objective standard of morality. In fact, I was sitting in the back of my public relations class in college, and I was not paying attention to public relations. I was drawing in a notebook, and I was thinking about this problem of evil and how evil is actually evidence for God. Because for something to be truly evil, you need an objective standard of right and wrong. And for an objective standard of right and wrong, you need God. So I kind of formulated an argument that goes like this: true evil exists in the world. If true evil exists, an objective standard of right and wrong exists. If an objective standard of right and wrong exists, then God exists. In other words, if one thing is wrong in the universe, God exists. Because without him, you have no basis by which to call anything evil or wrong. Without an objective standard of morality, you're just making a complaint about something. You're not saying it's actually wrong. So evil is actually evidence for God's existence. Furthermore, this logical problem of evil is rarely defended by most atheist philosophers because it places a huge burden of proof on the atheist that's kind of too much to show, because that you would have to show it's logically impossible for God to have any sufficient reasons for permitting evil. You'd also have to show that an all-loving God would desire to stop evil, because I can think of a world where evil would be more preferable, and we'll talk about that. So that leads us to the probabilistic version of this problem, because the logical problem you don't hear as much. This kind of goes like this, and it's a much more modest claim by the atheist: an all-loving God has the desire to stop evil. an all-powerful God has the ability to stop evil. Evil exists, therefore it's unlikely or improbable that God exists. And we're going to look at three reasons why I don't like this argument. One, it assumes a world without evil and suffering is preferable. Two, we're going to weigh it against the background knowledge. And three, no finite person is in a position to know whether or not God has reason to permit evil and suffering. And if you're not in a position to know whether God has reason to, you can't say with any confidence that he has no good reason to permit it. So, our first reason here, it assumes that God is all good, and prefers a world without pain and suffering. So what often happens when we go through trials and tribulations? What does James say happens when we encounter trials and tribulations? Count it all a joy. Because why? It builds character. And you see, God's goal for humanity isn't to make us happy as his little cosmic pets and provide us a great life. God's goal for humanity is to develop us as humans and to draw us unto himself. And in one of the ways he does that, as James says, is through pain and suffering. And so if God removed all the pain and suffering from the world, he would then no longer have that as a means to develop us and to grow our character. So to God's point of view, a world with pain and suffering is actually preferable because it gives him an avenue to help bring more people to him and develop their character. So this assumes that with a world without pain and suffering is preferable, but in reality, for God's purposes, it's not. Furthermore, stacked against other evidence, probability is weighed against... Yeah, Jeffrey.
Can I just challenge the last statement you made?
Sure.
When God created the earth, when God created Adam and Eve, when God created the Garden of Eden, was that without pain and suffering?
Yeah. It was preferable, but what was preferable is that Adam and Eve have a choice. So essentially the question is almost, why does God create people he knew would go to hell? And it's because a world where people have the ability to choose moral wrong as well as moral right is better than a world where people don't have the ability to choose at all. And so God making every effort to save them, it's not on him that they reject that effort to be saved. And God doesn't need anything, so him creating man is for our benefit. It's not for his benefit. Go ahead.
I just to answer that, it makes any sense. It's preferable now since the fall of man.
Right.
It was preferable that they would not suffer because they were sinless in the beginning.
Right.
And everything was good, but once the fall of mankind, then it became, I think you're saying, it's become preferable to God to allow suffering now because the ultimate good of saving them eventually.
And it's preferable for God to allow suffering now because it brings us closer to him. Adam and Eve were perfect in that sense and couldn't be closer to him. Yes. So.
Also in heaven, which is our ultimate goal, there is no pain, no suffering, no disobedience. So it would be interesting to see if man, once we're in heaven, there's no way we still have freedom of choice because we will choose in heaven. So that it's an interesting concept. The beginning was he didn't want people to suffer because he wanted to coexist with them and walk in the cool of the night. The flip side is after all the mess of the world until he comes again, when we end up in heaven, there is no, it's just like it was in the garden. He's returned it to that. Plus, evidently, he's removed the capacity for us, A, to sin. Therefore, he's removed the possibility of us having choice in heaven because we will do in heaven exactly what Adam and Eve did. He gives us that choice, and that's not what heaven is.
Well, I'm not sure I completely agree with you. Maybe that's something we can talk about in a men's breakfast sometime. Julie. No. Well, it depends. Did evil exist? Well, it depends on what you mean in the garden. Did evil exist in that realm before Satan goes into the garden? No. But evil isn't some entity that's out there. Evil is the absence of good. Right, but temptation isn't necessarily evil.
Did the devil exist before man was created?
Yes.
Yes, but this is something else we could talk about.
I don't know that we know.
Okay, we're getting off topic. We could talk about the issues with the garden. There's a lot of stuff there, and issues like, did God create evil? All that kind of stuff. Those are all questions I'm sure you have. But for the sake of time, because this is a lot, we're going to keep on plugging with God, why would he allow evil? And that leads us to our second reason, which is stacked against the other evidence. So probability is weighed against background knowledge. So if someone says that the evil in the world makes God's existence improbable, you should ask, well, compared to what? At first glance, you know, looking at all the evil in the world, it may seem improbable, but weighed against the background of theistic arguments, it doesn't. And so you see here the four we covered and then a bunch of other ones and then evil. So even if the argument from evil works, when you put it against the background knowledge of all the other arguments, it doesn't. To kind of illustrate this, let's say 90% of people at Millersville University love to eat at Longhorn Steakhouse. So it would be fair to assume that if you stopped on the street, stopped somebody on campus and asked them, do you like Longhorn Steakhouse? They would most likely enjoy Longhorn Steakhouse. Now let's say that person's name is John, and John is a vegetarian. And now let's say 90% of vegetarians that go to Millersville don't like Longhorn Steakhouse. Now what happens to the odds that John likes Longhorn Steakhouse? At first, it's about 90% because he's just an ordinary student. But when you weigh it against the background knowledge that now John is a vegetarian and vegetarians don't like Longhorn Steakhouse, the odds that he likes Longhorn Steakhouse drop significantly. And the same is likely here. If you just look at the problem of evil, you might say, well, you know, it looks improbable that God could exist. But when you weigh it against all the theistic arguments and everything else and look at it from the whole picture, it kind of drops the odds that God doesn't exist significantly. So our third reason is that no finite human is in a position to know whether or not God has morally sufficient reasons to permit evil, pain, and suffering. Therefore, since no one can know whether he has good reasons to or not, no one can say with any confidence that he doesn't. And therefore, you can't say with any confidence that he probably doesn't exist because of that. Also, being finite beings stuck in space and time, we shouldn't expect to see the reasons that God permits it. That doesn't mean there aren't reasons, but we live for 80-ish years, if we're lucky, we shouldn't expect to see the reasons that God permits evil. Have any of you heard of the butterfly effect? Would you mind explaining that? If you can explain it.
Yeah, well,
right, so the idea is that a butterfly flapping his wings in Africa can send forces into motion that cause a hurricane in the Atlantic Ocean. But you would never see from looking at that butterfly that the forces that come out on the other side. Similarly, there's an old Sliding Doors movie, and it's about this woman who is trying to catch a train. And the movie follows her through like two different lives. And in one life, she gets through the train doors and they close right behind her. And in the other life, there's a little girl playing with a doll on the stairs as she's running down. And she doesn't get on the train right away, and she misses the doors. And her life turns out drastically differently because in one version, she missed the doors, and in another version, she didn't miss the doors. And in the version where she missed the train, her life turns out great and happy, and she becomes successful and wealthy. And in the one where she made the train, she becomes very poor and angry and upset. And at the end of the movie, the happy version, she ends up dying suddenly in a car accident. And the person who was suffering for all those years because she didn't get to the train doors, her life turns out okay. And the point of the movie is to say how many minuscule things influence our day that we don't even realize. And so no one is to say with any confidence that God doesn't have the ability to ripple events through time. So maybe the suffering you're feeling right now will eventually lead to some great evangelist 500 years from now that you never see. But you aren't in a position to know whether God allows that. And just because you don't know doesn't mean he doesn't have good reason to. And the biblical authors kind of have a number of examples to explain evil and suffering. And we're going to get to that in a minute. But for now, I'd like you to turn to John 9. John 9. Can somebody read the first four verses of John 9?
And as he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? Jesus answered, it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but it was in order that the works of God might be displayed in him. He must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. Light is coming.
So, Jesus and his disciples are walking past, and they see a man who's blind from birth. So, he's a man, and two, he's been blind from birth. So I think it's okay to assume he's blind for at least 20 years or a couple of decades. So this man has been blind for a long time. And his disciple asked, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? So the disciples are asking the question, Jesus, why did you allow this man to be born blind? Why was his suffering permitted? And they even provide an answer that they think is right. Was it him who sinned? Was it his parents who sinned? They think that's the reason, that's the justified reason God has for allowing this man to suffer in this way, to be blind from birth. But that's not the answer Jesus gives. Jesus says it was neither that this man sinned nor his parents, but so that the works of God might be displayed in him. So then Jesus goes on and heals this man. So Jesus doesn't say it was because of sin. Jesus says that this man was born blind, so essentially, that I could heal him. And so Jesus heals him. All of those people witness there and see this miracle. Nobody in that situation but Jesus knows that John's going to write the events, those events down 60 years later in his gospel. And then that gospel is going to be put in a book called a Bible. And then this story is going to be taught for 2,000 years, down right to the day where some 20-year-old kid is telling this man's story on a different continent. So this man's blindness was so much bigger than him. God used this man's blindness to spread his word and to reach millions of people over thousands of years over different continents. This man never imagined that his blindness would be a story being taught by, we wouldn't even know what a church is, by some kid in a church in North America in 2,000 years. He had no concept of what that happens. And the same can be true for us. You never know how God can use your suffering today and how he can ripple it down through time to have great effects and to have great good. This man suffered blindness for a long time until he was healed. But it was ultimately justified because God used it for so much good. And the same can be true for us today. Even if we don't see the butterfly effects of what happens, it doesn't mean that it's not happening. So, as I was saying a little bit earlier, now we're going to kind of get to this, the biblical authors kind of provide a number of reasons as to why God would allow pain and suffering. And I'm not saying we should try and discover each reason in our own individual lives, but we can understand why God allows it in general.
More that happens to you, and the more you can overcome, the stronger you
Right. So, that's a great point. So this is kind of broken down into two kind of sections. Moral evil and natural evil, or just pain or suffering, and that would be like disease or natural disasters or things such as that. So, this might be dangerous because you might steal my thunder, but can anyone think of reasons as to why God would allow either moral evil or natural evil and suffering? Similar to what Dan just said. Right, so punishment. Is God just in punishing sin? Is that a good reason to permit evil? Is God wrong when he punishes somebody for sin, and that's an evil that he permits for that reason? No, that's not wrong. That's a good reason God can allow evil. Did you have one? Use your hand up. Okay, Rick forgets.
It gives us a choice.
A choice. Exactly. No, I think I follow what you're saying. So, interestingly enough, and if you talk to my dad about this, he will tell you, first, dealing with moral evil, Rick would especially tell you this. We live in a fallen world. That's one of Dad's catchphrases. We live in a fallen world because of whose sin? Did Adam have a free choice to sin? Therefore, all the evil in the world is technically a result of a free will choice to sin. That answer doesn't quite satisfy me, although it's technically correct. But we're going to get into a little bit more reasons as to why God would still allow that to happen. Yes.
The same as Adam? I'm not sure I quite understand. Well, I mean, they walked with God, but then they ultimately did evil and sin.
I was going to say, technically, it's not apples to apples. It's not the same context for that. But everybody has a sense.
Also, God in his omniscience can know that Adam and Eve are our perfect representatives, and if any of us were Adam and Eve, we would have made the same decision. But we also have a fair shot because you're born upright and holy. You also have a fair shot to choose good and not evil, the same way they did, despite not walking in the garden. And again, the temptation isn't exactly as strong either, because you don't have a snake talking to you, a serpent talking to you, saying, eat this fruit. So the temptation is not as immediate, you know, for us. So it's different, but it doesn't mean it's not equal.
So
go Dad first. So, moral evil can be explained by God giving man free choice. You know, man has the free will to commit murder, they can steal, they can commit genocide, they can do horrible things. And they have done horrible things. More people have been killed in the last 120 years than at any other point in human history because of the world wars and just terrible things that went on. You know, the Nazis did terrible experiments to children. They put people in gas chambers. They sewed people together. You know, they tortured people. The Japanese did worse things that the Nazis actually stepped in and said, hey, this is going too far. You shouldn't do this. And if the Nazis are telling you you're on the moral low ground, you're doing something really wrong. But the point is, people have committed atrocities and genocides or things like the Holocaust forever. And it's a very human thing to do. We think like to think of those things as humane, but this is repetitive throughout history. So why doesn't God step in and stop any of it? And that's often the complaint is yes, they have free will to do those things, but why wouldn't God hear those crying out for mercy, and why wouldn't he step in and stop that? Wouldn't he be merciful and step in and stop that? And the thing is, if God wants to give you true free will, if he steps in and stops every single evil thing that you do before it happens, then he's not really giving you free will. And in Alvin Plantinga, he's a philosopher, he's a professor at Notre Dame, he's a free will defense. And in that, he argues that a world where humans can live and choose moral good along with moral bad is better than a world where you can't choose either at all. You see, if God were to take away all the evils and all the hate and all the murder and the genocide, he'd also have to take away the choice to choose all the good things, like love. And that really isn't a life worth living. And so he, Alvin Plantinga in this, argues that a world with evil and good where you can choose is better than a world where you don't have a choice at all. And I find that very compelling. And for God to give everyone free choice, he can't step in like a cosmic babysitter and stop you. Absolutely. And as I've kind of said, a world where we have the freedom to choose moral wrong and moral bad is better than a world without choice at all. So that can explain the evil and suffering that goes on, and God allows that, like you said, like a parent allows a child to fail so they learn. But that doesn't quite explain all of suffering. Did you want to say something? Paul would say the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. So you're absolutely right in saying that, and that is well said. A lot of times in the Old Testament, we're given those reasons. For example, the earth was flooded, God's judging the world for their evil deeds. That's the reason that natural disaster happened. Or Jesus always looks at natural disasters as things like that. He sees them as a call to repentance, as to bringing people back to Him. And so that was my next question. While freedom of the will explains, you know, why moral evil happens, and where Dave was starting to lead into why natural evil or suffering happens. Why do babies die after they're being born? Why does cancer kill so many people? Why does God permit natural disasters and earthquakes and hurricanes to kill so many people? Why does He allow that? And as Dave was starting to get into, in the Old Testament, we're given examples of why God allowed that to happen, whether it be punishment or judgment, whether He used that to bring more people to Him and develop their character, and so that those people would learn to rely on Him, whether He did it to discipline them. Hebrews talks about God disciplining us.
But Jesus provided a boundary to that concept. When He talked about, did the tower of Rome, you know, that it fell on and crushed and killed some people, were they any worse sinners than the rest of you? And He said the answer is no. So we can't always think that, okay, I'm having suffering in my life, you know, therefore it's the cause of this.
Right, and I think I'm not quite sure. It wasn't until the very end that maybe Job started to get why all of that happened. And I'm not saying that we ought to try to figure out in our own lives why these things are happening. I'm just saying we've been given reasons as to why God permits it. And even if we don't know the reason, we can trust that God does have a reason for it.
See, you keep using the term God allows it. God causes. He didn't allow the flood. He caused flood. You know, he didn't allow.
For reference, I'm using those terms interchangeably.
But it's, we have to realize it didn't just by happenstance or God said, oh, there's no other way to do this, so I'm going to allow it. He steps in Isaiah 45, verse 7. He creates prosperity and He creates, depending on your translation, calamity. Evil, fill in the, that's why there was a big uproar when the King James translated that word evil. But He does it, and He does it ultimately for one purpose, and that's for the good of those who are going to be, or who are His children.
Right, there was a couple other hands. Right, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think Jesus said something interesting in Matthew 13 when He's telling a parable of the wheat and the tares, if you want to turn there. Matthew 13. So, starting in verse 28, and He said to them, an enemy has done this. The slave said to Him, do you want us then to go and gather them up? But He said, no, for while you are gathering up the tares, you may uproot the wheat with them. And so I just think this is kind of cool, and that's what I have number 7 here. It seems as if Jesus is saying, don't uproot the evil, because if you uproot the evil, it's also going to uproot the good with it. And I did want to touch on something Dave said earlier, because often people will say, well, why do bad things happen to good people? You know, why do good people suffer? They shouldn't, They shouldn't suffer. God shouldn't let bad things happen to good people. And R.C. Sproul, who's a theologian, has a phenomenal quote. And it goes like this. Why do bad things happen to good people? That only happened once and he volunteered. The truth about it is no one is good, not one. No one seeks after God. All have turned astray and gone their own way. If you spend any time around Rick, you've had Romans 3, 10 to 12 quoted at you. So no one is good. So the idea that bad things happen to good people just isn't a fair premise. Bad things happen to bad people. You know, we're all deserving of judgment and punishment or discipline or things like that. And so bad things don't ever happen to good people. Oftentimes we don't see our own depravity and our own evil. It's easy to look at other people and see what's wrong with them, but we really don't understand the depth of our own depravity and how wrong and how dead sin we are and how deserving of judgment we are. So bad things don't ever happen to good people.
Also, since I'm reading through Psalms, over and over again, David makes this statement. Why do the wicked prosper and the good condemn? You know, so it's a universal question that's being asked, even from a man like David, as he looked around and saw what happened in the world around him. And he wants those evil people punished. I mean, you know, the concept of, pray for your enemies. Boy, I tell you, read the Psalms, and David ain't praying for good stuff for his enemies in any way, shape, or form. He wants them wiped out. But the question he always bring up, as I said, was why do you allow or cause the wicked to prosper and your own people to falter and be in terrible conditions? Another question for us.
Shane? No, and oftentimes we're working through the intellectual part of this problem. Oftentimes it's such a strong argument because it's full of emotion. But the emotion is really saying, I don't like this. This doesn't feel good. Fix it. Do something about it. God, make me happy because right now this sucks. That's the reality of what we're feeling. And that's why people leave. They don't often think, you know, maybe there's a good reason for this. And it's right. You're right. It's a warning against pride. It's not about us. It's not about me being happy. And that's where a lot of people tend to go. So I that's actually what we're going to kind of get into next week is a warning against pride in that sense.
Wouldn't you agree that evil and suffering are separate?
Yeah.
Because I look at Jesus. He definitely wasn't evil in any way, shape, or form, but God allowed him to suffer unbelievable when he went and to be crucified.
Absolutely. And that was kind of our quote in the beginning, is God is the only hope and the only solution to suffering. And he's not a distant creator that's looking down and watching us suffer and go through it alone. God suffered with us in Jesus on the cross, and he suffered more than anybody else has ever, because he bore the weight of all the sins of the entire world in that one moment. And so he suffered more than any human can. And so he's the only good one. So who are we to say, you know, why am I allowed to suffer when God himself suffers more than we ever will? And even if we never see why you were allowed to go through pain and suffer, we've talked about how freedom of the will kind of explains the moral evil that goes on in the world, how God has reasons like discipline and judgment and punishment and growth and character development and things like that, for permitting natural evil, things like hurricanes or deaths or cancer, the things like that, where he has just reasons for allowing that. But even if we never see those reasons and we never come to understand that, and I'm not saying we should try and figure out God's reasons for permitting that in our own lives, I'm just saying there are. Even if we never see that, we can trust that God is good, and that he's working things out for good, for the good of those who love him, and that he will be perfectly moral, just, and holy in doing so. And I just want to ask, does anybody have, you have a comment? Yeah, do you have your hand up? Right, and God justifies it all in the end. In the end, when we get to heaven, it's all taken care of. It's all made right. And so the tiny bit of suffering we spend here doesn't compare to eternity at all. It's all justified and made right.
If you look at pain, suffering, loss, happiness, and need, if you look around, no one escapes it. Everyone is like pain, suffering, and loss. And so why me, but then everyone takes their turn. You look around, you had your suffering today, but then this guy next to you, all of a sudden something happens to them that makes it worse or just as devastating. Death doesn't escape anyone. We all learn that. And then, so you go, you're looking for something better than this. You're looking for something higher. You're looking for, you know, that's where God comes in. There is something greater than all of this that we all have to go through. That's why we're a family here now, because we all help each other out.
Right. And so intellectually speaking, pain and evil and suffering don't bring a challenge to the goodness or to the holiness of God or the existence of God. If evil is really a bad thing, it actually is evidence that God exists, because you need a standard by which to call something evil. And so it intellectually, I don't think it's that big of a problem. It's the emotional part of that we struggle with. And I hope what you take away from today is that while there is tremendous pain and evil and suffering in the world, there are good reasons as to why it exists, whether it be human free will or growth or discipline or punishment or judgment or a number of things. If you read, if you just read through Scripture, the biblical authors give many different reasons as to why suffering happens. And even if you never know why it happens in your own life or in another life somebody close to you, again, I'm not trying to say you should figure it out, you can know that there's a reason for it, or that God's not abandoning you. And somebody who's struggling with that, you can assure them that God's not abandoning them. God hasn't forgotten about them, that he's still there, and he can use that for their good.
A couple weeks ago we had a study on Hebrews 11, and within those passages, none of those people received the promise in this life, but they all were looking forward to, as it says, a country, a faraway country, better known as heaven. So you want to see a whole list of people who went through all kinds of hardship and evil, just read Hebrews 11 and look at the conclusion that it comes to at the end of it.
Right. So, and I'm sure we all can sit here and think of ways that God has used pain or trials in our own life and has brought us closer to him or used it for his good. I'm positive that all of us can think of, whether it be a time in our life or a time in somebody else's life, that God used a tough situation for his good or to bring us closer to him, or that you eventually saw the reason. And so those reasons are there. They're not far from you. And so that's really what I want you to take away from today. While it is a powerful emotional argument, intellectually, it does not challenge the existence of God, because God has reasons for permitting evil, even if we never see them or know them. And no one's in a position to say he doesn't with any confidence. Any final comments or questions? That's time anyway. I'm being told I gotta stop. And that was the first time I went late. Rick and Jeffrey go over all the time.